something in the back of my mind says not you. But I know that, cause for 4 years you've been my boo. So through all the fighting and fussing like it was nothing, see, you went to punching and I repent for the cussing. But we'd make up and break up like every night. Fuck to that Jacob, but something inside just ain't right. I met this little chick though not long ago. She had me down, my round was like, yo, come on. See, I ain't lying, she was fine by her appearance, but the problem came in, cause the life she was living. I met this little chick though not long ago.
This land is mine, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest, the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the People Speak Radio Show. This is Basma Farhat, your host for this evening. We here believe that when the people speak, they make a difference. Tonight we speak with Dahir Jamail, an independent journalist who in the late 2003 grew tired and weary of the lack of information coming to us from the U.S. media and went to accurately report on the realities of the war in Iraq. Dahir Jamail went to Iraq himself. His dispatches were quickly recognized as an important media source. He's now writing for the International Press Service, the Asia Times, and many other outlets. His reports have been published in The Nation, The Sunday Herald, Islam Online, The Guardian, Foreign Policy on Focus, and The Independent, just to name a few. Hello, Dahir. How are you? And welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
Where are you reporting from now, Dahir?
Well, right now I'm at home out in the Bay Area of California, and I've been continuing to do news reports covering mostly Iraq, by using Iraqi colleagues of mine there still on the ground in various places.
So your main focus is still the Iraqi war?
It is, yes.
Why did you feel the need to report on this war and to go there yourself? Is there a personal investment in this, Dahir?
Well, it's primarily because I think a combination of really the time of when I kind of became politicized as an individual here in the United States just happened to coincide with the rough time of during the build-up to the war with Iraq. And so I had was reading enough of overseas reports about, for example, the UN weapons inspectors and the reality of what was happening in Iraq and comparing that to how it was being portrayed over here as far as how the war was being sold to the American people based on lies. And so, of course, going into the war, me, like millions of other people in this country, could see very clearly that this war had nothing to do with liberating the Iraqi people or for finding weapons of mass destruction or any of the other lies. And so really all of that kind of came to a head for me, and I contrasted that with how all of this information was being reported or not reported by the mainstream media here. And I was outraged by the so-called coverage in the media, and that's what led me to make the decision to go over to Iraq and try to report on it myself.
You called Fallujah the microcosm of the war. This was in 2003. Do you see it any differently now? And what did you mean by that?
No, I think it's still the same, and I made that reference because Fallujah really, if you look at, for example, the events, and I'm referring even more specifically to the second siege of the city, the November 2004 U.S.-led assault on the city that essentially destroyed approximately 70% of the entire city. And I refer to it as a microcosm of the entire Iraq War because, once again, the siege of the city was based on lies and misinformation and disinformation by the Bush administration and then propagated by the corporate media. Because if you look at the excuses given for the siege of the city, the Bush administration claimed that the entire city was being controlled by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and in reality that man had never even set foot inside the city. and that the people of the city were actually trying to defend it themselves against the U.S. occupation forces. But nevertheless, the lies were used to sell the assault on the entire city to the American people. And then, of course, promises were made that, yes, we probably will have to use harsh methods during the siege, but we will be doing reconstruction projects and helping the people of Fallujah rebuild. And to this day, almost 3 years after that siege took place, there are still entire neighborhoods and districts of that city that do not have electricity, water, jobs, medical care, etc. So much like Iraq, as far as lies being based to justify an illegal attack, and then promises being made, and of course none of them being fulfilled, and of course a massive display of massive U.S. firepower along the way. In all of those ways, the second siege of Fallujah really was a microcosm of the entire assault on Iraq.
Do you believe, Dahid, that we have to literally deconstruct Iraq to find out why the reconstruction of Iraq has not worked and has not been a success at all?
Well, to a degree, but I think this is not a complicated endeavor. If we talk about really deconstructing the whole situation to look at the reasons why there hasn't been the reconstruction or fulfillment, really, of any of the promises made by the Bush administration, we don't have to dig very deep. As we already discussed, really, you know, it's very clear to, at this point, to basically anyone that's even remotely interested in the facts and putting their political ideology aside, if anyone just looks at the hard facts, at this point, anyone with a pulse can see that the reasons given to justify the invasion were all lies. They were misrepresentations, disinformation, and just really blatant lies. And literally, there are many well-documented instances where all along the line, the Bush and the Blair administrations fabricated evidence or horribly misconstrued information that did exist to justify the war. And the same thing can be said regarding the promises made for the reconstruction, where there was basically no oversight in Iraq, so that these cost-plus, no-bid, fixed-fee contracts given to these Western corporations, like Bechtel, for example, out of San Francisco, there was basically no oversight on the ground whatsoever that any of the projects would be completed, let alone projects even being started. So we had a situation with Bechtel, for example, where last November they pulled out of the country entirely, and were paid $2.3 billion for work, although most of that work wasn't even done. So, again, if we just look at the cold, hard facts of what contracts were awarded, how many were paid out, and contrast that with what work was actually done on the ground, you know, we can see once again it was a bunch of empty promises. Little to know of them, if any of them were even fulfilled, and then those left paying the highest price, once again, were the Iraqi people.
You know, in one interview, Dahid, you quoted that the reconstructionists received over $1 billion for Iraqi reconstruction, and you asked in that article, where has the money gone? Statistics now are saying that over $123 billion were allotted for the reconstruction of Iraq. Have you found the source of the money yet, or where the money's gone yet?
Well, the vast majority of that money has gone into the coffers of these Western corporations that were awarded these contracts. Companies like Halliburton, Kellogg, their subsidiary, Kellogg Brown and Root, companies like Bechtel, companies like Blackwater Security. I mean, we can go on down the list and point to many, many, many Western companies, so the vast majority of them either U.S. or U.K.-based. And these are basically the pits where the billions and billions, tens of billions of dollars of so-called reconstruction money has gone and security money has gone, although there are still, even according to, for example, the Coalition Provisional Authority, which was the first U.S. civil authority set up to govern Iraq after the regime of Saddam Hussein was removed. So if you think back, it was roughly for the first year of the occupation. The CPA ran things It was headed, of course, by Paul Bremer, formerly of Kissinger and Associates. And under the CPA's watch, over $7 billion of Iraqi reconstruction money went, quote-unquote, missing. So, of course, that money, even according to the CPA, if it went missing, even according to their so-called accounting records, we have no idea where that money went, what it was used for, and where it is today, of course.
From everything that we've been able to see, literally the Iraqi people have been funding their own reconstruction, have they not? Considering all of the monies that have disappeared in the earlier part of the war, if I'm not mistaken, they're paying. The Iraqi people are paying for this.
Well, that's an important point. The Iraqi people, if you remember back, the original reconstruction money, at least $18 billion of it was money from the Iraqi people, that it was money from the previous regime that was supposed to be used to help reconstruct the country and give the Iraqi people something to use to move forward from the old regime and into theoretically into a future where they were going to have more say in where that money went, what it was going to be used for. But that money essentially was never under their control, ever. The CPA came in, took control of all of it, and as I just outlined, roughly over one-third of that money went literally missing, which I think we can probably assume that much of it basically just went into pockets of various people who could get their hands on it. Needless to say, none of that went into reconstruction projects. And then the rest of it, the brunt of that actually went into so-called security contractor companies, so like the Blackwater USAs and other groups like that, theoretically carrying out security, were being paid off, and that was being paid for by the Iraqi money. But another huge percentage of the reconstruction money actually did come from U.S. taxpayers. That you know, when we hear these astronomical numbers of how much the occupation of Iraq is costing, which is now over $2 billion a week, well, the brunt of that money at this point is being paid for by U.S. taxpayers. So when schools in people's cities here in the United States don't have enough money to get new books or to have the programs for students, et cetera, or when there's not enough medical care here at home, and we look at the fact, recent statistics showing nearly 50 million Americans do not have any kind of health insurance whatsoever. These are just a couple of the broad brush strokes of ways that people here are paying for it, because we don't have our own basic infrastructure here, and there's less today than ever, and there will be even less tomorrow. And so these are some of the ways that U.S. taxpayers are also paying for Iraq. And if we look at just the overall a Pentagon budget nowadays, the most recent Pentagon budget, annual budget, is almost $500 billion, and that does not include the Iraq or the Afghanistan wars. So we're looking at $500 billion a year going into the Pentagon budget, and that's not even including Iraq.
Just amazing. Folks, we're talking with Zahir Jamayel, an independent journalist that did a majority of reports on Iraq. For any questions you have for Zahir, you can call internationally toll-free, 888-228-4494. The telephone number, again, is 888-228-4494. And you can also raise your hands and speak in our virtual auditorium. Zahir, in one of your articles, you quoted the U.S. commanders in Iraq, and they compare the battling of the Iraqi resistance to stepping on a half-filled water balloon. Your article said, you step on one part and it squeezes out the other side. Why do you think that is, Zahir?
Well, and that's actually an analogy that I repeated, because it's from U.S. commanders on the ground in Iraq that have their hands more than full trying to take on the Iraqi resistance. And that's exactly how they described it, where it's as if they're trying to step on a half-full water balloon, that you can step on one area, and then the water's just going to go to all the other areas where your boot is not. And that's a quite accurate description if you really look at it, because You know, they can go in and stomp hard on parts of Baghdad, and the resistance just spreads to the other parts of the capital city. They can go in and flatten the city of Fallujah and then effectively spread the resistance throughout the rest of Al-Anbar province. They can surge a 30,000 troops mostly into Baghdad, and then we see once again resistance cropping up all around the south, out to the east and northeast, like Diyala province, Salah ad-Din provinces, and then back, of course, in areas in the north like Mosul, and then even up in the Kurdish-controlled north, which before the surge we didn't see that much violence, and now there's more violence, in, particularly in Kirkuk, than ever before. So that's why the U.S. military used that analogy, and I think it's very accurate. And, you know, the bottom line is when you put a conventional military like the U.S. military into a guerrilla war where they're fighting a very unconventional, fluid, dynamic force, the conventional military never wins these conflicts. And this is why we see historically occupations always fail, whether it's this occupation or the occupation that the Israeli occupation in the occupied territories of Palestine, that given time, and it, sometimes it may take decades, but given time, conventional militaries always fail. And, of course, we don't have to look too far back in U.S. history to Vietnam to see the last time the U.S. was in a country trying to occupy large swaths of it, and, of course, we all know what happened there.
We have a question from Matt from Kansas. Matt, what is your question for Dahid, please?
Yes. There's been also reports that the troop surge is possibly working. Is that true from the colleagues is telling you on the ground? Thank you.
The question, is, if I heard it right, let me repeat it, so correct me if I'm wrong, but is that the question is that there's information that the troop surge is actually working?
And yes, that was his question.
Correct? Right. Actually, this is blatant. I've seen those reports, of course, coming from the Bush administration. Of course, Bush recently just flew into Al-Asad Air Base, which is actually in Al-Anbar province, other information coming from General Petraeus, and kind of the buildup of information at the forefront of this upcoming report, probably in less than 2 weeks from today, where General Petraeus, the head U.S. military commander of Iraq and the U.S. ambassador in Baghdad to Iraq, Ryan Crocker, are going to give a joint address to Congress. We fully expect this to be a more flowery, hopeful report of things in Iraq. And I think some of these preliminary news releases and kind of these news, so-called news pieces that, like, well, the troop surge is actually working, is a bit of preliminary propaganda to try to get public opinion going in the right direction for this upcoming report back. And if you, again, I always defer to the hard numbers on the ground as to whether or not the so-called troop surge is working. And if you just look at that, that means we're talking about roughly the last 6 months in Iraq. That's about how long this so-called surge has been going on. And this has been the bloodiest 6 months of the occupation for Iraqi civilians. There's been more sectarian deaths in Iraq in this last 6 months than any other six-month period of the entire occupation. If you look at the number of U.S. troop deaths, the last 6 months has also been one of the, if not the bloodiest, 6 months of the entire occupation. And I would cite specifically the first few months of this summer. I believe it was April, May, June, were three of the bloodiest months of the entire occupation.
I think even August, if I'm not mistaken, has topped that, Dahid.
For Iraqi civilians, it has. For U.S. troops, it's dropped back down to about three a day, which is still quite a very, very high number if you look at the first 1-2 years of the occupation. And now we're considering a lower number of U.S. troops per month to be when almost 90 a month are being killed. So my point is that in the last 6 months we've seen escalations of violence basically across the board for Iraqi civilians, for sectarian killings, for U.S. troops and the number of U.S. troops being wounded. And then, of course, we had the Oxfam report Oxfam International, in conjunction with Iraqi NGOs and other international NGOs, that they released a very detailed report that I would actually refer people to read. It's a very important report. This came out at the very end of July, so it's very recent information. And that report found that 8 million people, so roughly one-third of the entire population of Iraq, is in dire need of emergency assistance. This means that if this segment of the population, 30% of the population, does not promptly receive medical assistance, food, water, basic things for survival, then they're at very high risk of perishing. It found that 92% of Iraqi children had quote-unquote learning impediments. Basically, you can read that as severe post-traumatic stress disorder from living in a combat environment. Nearly one-half of the entire population of the country is living in abject poverty. That means they're living on less than $1 every single day. There's been a 9% increase in childhood malnutrition, even compared to the sanctions period, which even according to Madeleine Albright, former President Bill Clinton, Secretary of State, admitted to Leslie Stahl on CBS 60 Minutes 2 that, yes, 500,000 Iraqi children had died, and we think that the price is worth it. And so even compared to that time frame, when that many people were dying in Iraq, that we've had a 9% increase in childhood malnutrition. So these are, I could go on and on with statistics like this, but these are all statistics that have come out within the last 6 months of the so-called troop surge.
Well, I think the most serious, and this it seems that statistics no longer sway the American people. It no longer sways a certain population voting blocks. The fact that we are killing in an unprecedented way for unprecedented reasons, no one even really knows what the reasons are, is just phenomenal. We have a call from Mike from California. I'm sorry. Mike, please come put your question to Dahit.
Hello, Dar. My question is, how does the ordinary American soldier treat the average Iraqi? I mean, we've only heard about the high-profile atrocities, Abu Ghraib, the Haditha massacre, the rape of Abir Qasim Hamza, and we are led to believe that this is the work of a few bad apples. How does the average American soldier that encounters the average American Iraqi treat them? Thank you.
That's a good question. And really, the situation, I want to just be real clear up front, because I don't want to generalize that, you know, there certainly is a significant percentage of troops in Iraq. I mean, definitely less than 50%, but I think still a sizable percentage of the U.S. soldiers serving there that are doing their best to try to behave according to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, trying to abide by some sort of international law, trying to handle Iraqis with respect and with dignity, and be very, very careful so as not to generate more casualties on the ground than are absolutely necessary. But that said, I would still say that from my own direct experience, in addition to the reports I continue to get for the last couple of years from my Iraqi colleagues, journalist colleagues on the ground in various parts of Iraq, is that still well over 50% of U.S. soldiers there are basically using a shoot-first-ask-questions-later policy. I've even interviewed soldiers myself that have come back to the U.S., Iraq war vets, that have said that very thing, that no, we were basically on a shoot-first-ask-questions-later policy. And this is because it's a very clear no-win situation for U.S. troops serving in Iraq, where they're basically put in a situation that they were led into by lies, and then they're there on the ground, and they're basically in survival mode. And Robert J. Lifton is a famous psychologist who actually came up with post-traumatic stress disorder after working with Vietnam veterans, and he referred to Vietnam, and I think we can apply the same model to Iraq, as an atrocity-producing situation or an atrocity-generating situation. And that is because when you take soldiers in, again, a conventional military, and you put them in essentially a guerrilla war situation where they're fighting people who kind of meld out of cities and then launch attacks and then meld back into the civilian population, of course, then the soldiers become very afraid. They don't know when the next car coming towards them is going to be a car bomb or not. So they're going to basically shoot first and then ask questions later. Same with when people approach them. And this has led to a very, very high number of civilian casualties in Iraq being generated by U.S. soldiers. Factoring into that, of course, the very dramatically escalated use of airstrikes as well. So, again, I don't want to generalize. I absolutely won't say that every U.S. soldier in Iraq is carrying out atrocities on a regular basis, because that's not true. However, the majority of the soldiers there, because they're in a no-win and desperate situation and they're fearing for their lives on a daily basis, are generating massive numbers of casualties. They're killing civilians. They're shooting so many cars at checkpoints on a daily basis. And on their patrols, anytime they're ever attacked, they basically just open fire on anything that's moving. And this is, unfortunately, more the norm than not across Iraq. And again, just to give a little perspective on why they're using this more shoot first, ask questions later policy, it's because that if you look, for example, at May alone, there were over 6,000 attacks launched against U.S. and Iraqi security forces just in that month alone. So to give you an idea of the ferocity of the resistance and the massive amount of fighting that's going on in Iraq, I mean, it's not like U.S. soldiers are being attacked only every once in a while or a few times a day. We're talking about hundreds of attacks every single day. And so it is a war. And that's the information that most people here in the United States don't get, that soldiers being put over in Iraq are literally fighting for their own survival. And so, of course, naturally, being that it's a guerrilla war, this is going to lead to a very high number of atrocities.
Remember, folks, our telephone number here is 888-228-4494. That's the international toll-free number. And you can place your questions to Zaha Jamil, independent reporter from Iraq. Our next question and caller is from, I believe it's Nellie from Houston, Texas. Nellie, please give your question for us.
Yes, good evening, Mr. Jamil. My name is Nela. I'm from Houston, originally from Germany. My question to you is, we all know there is many Iraqi people speaking perfectly English, where the military depends on. Without this help to overcome this language barrier, the soldiers are there lost. I heard in recent reports that people just put their job down, they don't want to work for the American people any longer because they will get killed. They kill their families, they kill everybody. So have you heard anything, if they protect these people, if people can come here to the United States on a probably a temporary visa condition, is there any news on it? Because I know many journalists even put their job down because they're very afraid they get killed. I hope my question is not too out of it. It was just a big concern of me because I believe these people help the Americans to overcome a language barrier and will get dropped like a hot potato after a while. Many, many journalists have been killed, and you know this. Thank you so much, Mr. Jamil.
No, thank you, and that's a really good question, actually. And I did a radio piece on this relatively recently where one of my Iraqi colleagues helped me find several people in Iraq who had worked as translators for the U.S. military. And they haven't, basically the caller hit the nail on the head in that people, Iraqis who have risked their lives to work with the occupation or with the military as translators have basically been left high and dry, that they really have not been offered any visas, even temporary visas, to come to the United States. Let me put it in a little bit of perspective, where we're looking at a situation now in Iraq where the group Refugees International has called the situation the fastest growing refugee crisis on the planet. We're looking at well over 2 million Iraqis inside of Iraq that have become internally displaced, meaning that they're basically refugees within their own country. And then we're looking at well over 2 million, actually closer to 3 million now, Iraqis that have had to flee the country altogether. Nearly 2 million of those have gone into Syria alone. By stark contrast, the number of U.S. visas issued to Iraq by the Bush administration since March 2003, the month the invasion was launched, is 801. So despite promises made that Iraqis working for the U.S. military or the occupation forces would be taken care of and they would be granted priority visa status and these kinds of things that were told to these people, because that's what they told me that they were told by the people they were working for in Iraq, that's just simply not been the case. And so a couple of men I spoke with recently that were in this situation basically said they were relegated to sitting at their homes because they were receiving death threats on a regular basis. They couldn't leave. Several of them had actually, that I had also interviewed for the story, had actually left their home and had to go to a different city so as not to be killed. They'd had family members threatened. So these people basically laid it all on the line and risked their life and the lives of their families to work with the occupation as translators, and what they've gotten in return is nothing. They're not being admitted visas to come to this country for their own safety, and you know the bind that they are in is due to the fact that the Bush administration, if they were going to start admitting tens or hundreds of thousands of Iraqis into this country, it would be a blatant admission of the total failure of the occupation of Iraq. And so I don't see any time in the near or really even distant future at this point where this or any other future administration in this country is going to start issuing very large numbers of visas to Iraqis, because to do so would be an admission of defeat in the catastrophic situation that Iraq has become.
Thank you, Dahed. Our next caller is from Noah from Iowa. Noah, your question to Dahed, please.
I was calling to see what his opinion is on about George Bush and Cheney taking us into Iran using air targets and basically an air war. I had heard a little bit about that and was wondering your opinion.
Thank you, Noah.
No, that's another very important question. And I've actually just recently finished working on a story hopefully it will be published in Foreign Policy and Focus soon that's going to touch on this. And I mention that because as part of the story, I interviewed many ex-CIA individuals, many of them still with quite strong connections into that agency, and, of course, with a lot of information about this possibility with airstrikes against Iran. And it has actually even come out just within the last week that the Bush administration had already drawn up plans to launch massive three-day airstrikes on it's approximately 1,200 targets across Iraq, where the goal of this three-day operation will be to basically demolish and destroy the infrastructure of Iran's military apparatus in a three-day period. Basically, the CIA people that I've talked to about this have described it as complete lunacy, that Iran, just for starters, is three times the size geographically of Iraq. It has three times the population. It did not just go through a 13-year period of genocidal sanctions. Their military is very much intact and very capable of responding not just to attacking them in retaliation, U.S. military targets inside of Iraq, meaning every U.S. base there, and especially the Green Zone, but fully capable of attacking targets in other countries around the Middle East. So we're talking about U.S. military installations around the Gulf region, like in Doha, Qatar, or in Bahrain, which is where the Fifth Fleet is anchored. But we're talking about, of course, the U.S. ally Israel will then be a hard target for retaliation attacks from the Iranian military. And also, I would cite a Pentagon insider, a Pentagon specialist, who was interviewed by Seymour Hersh, who did a piece in the New Yorker covering this topic several months ago. And according to this Pentagon source, southern Iraq, once the U.S. launches attacks on Iran, will, quote-unquote, light up like a candle. And that's because southern Iraq is basically already controlled by two very large, very powerful Shiite militias with ties to Iran, and those are the Badr organization and the Mahdi army of the cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. We can look right off the bat as far as how this will affect us back here. Basically, every American traveling abroad will be much less safe. They will then be targets for terrorist organizations or kidnappings. And then, of course, we can look at the entire oil infrastructure in the Gulf to be torched by Iranian missiles. This is a largely unprotected infrastructure, and we can look for that to be struck very, very heavily. And then we can look for, of course, our economy here to suffer immediate consequences from that, where, of course, gasoline would almost overnight shoot up to over $4 a gallon. The value of the U.S. dollar against the euro will plummet. What that will do to our economy, I think, speaks for itself without too much analysis. So these are just a few of the things that we could expect when this attack happens. And when will it happen? I don't really know. I've already guessed in the past that it was going to happen this past spring, and I was wrong. But with new information, and take this with a grain of salt, I could be wrong again. But basically, it looks like it could happen any time from basically right now until probably this coming summer. Personally, right now, with the renewed information and some of the information I've obtained from talking to some of the CIA folks from various stories I've been working on, is if I had to guess, I would say it would happen probably sometime this spring, if not sooner.
That's pretty frightening and looming in the horizon, I do have to admit. Go ahead, we have some serious issues with that. Our next question is from Judy from, South Dakota, I'm sorry. Judy from South Dakota, please give us a brief question for Daher. We've got a couple more minutes, and we'd like to get a couple more questions in.
Okay. My question to you, sir, is why aren't you saying anything about the IEDs or the suicide bombers? Why aren't you condemning them instead of talking about the military? Why you aren't condemning them? It's your mic.
Well, the response is simply because the question has not come up yet. I certainly don't condone any of the violence being carried out in Iraq today. If it were a perfect world, there would have been some other solution to the situation in Iraq without a U.S. military invasion of that country, which contravened international law. And since it did contravene international law, also according to international law, it's the Iraqi people's right to resist a foreign invasion and, of course, a foreign occupation. So Iraqi resistance attacks against the U.S. military, however brutal and savage they may be, including suicide bombings, including car bombs, still pale in comparison to the level of violence being produced by the U.S. military. And this is not opinion. These are from hard statistics gleaned from a study, the only scientific study of Iraqi civilian casualties carried out in Iraq, and that's by Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Health right here in the United States. The results of their more recent study were published last October in the peer-reviewed British medical journal The Lancet, and that survey found 655,000 excess deaths as a result of the U.S.-led occupation and invasion. And also by that survey, we can point very directly to the U.S. military as being the single largest producer of Iraqi civilian casualties. So while in U.S. corporate media we see much, much coverage of car bombs and spectacular suicide attacks and carnage caused by these horrible methods, horrible as those are and vicious as they are, and as I said, I don't condone those in any way, those attacks, though, still pale by comparison by what happens when an F-16 drops a 2,000-pound bomb in the middle of an urban environment and scores of people are wiped out at a go, sometimes even hundreds. But those attacks, of course, rarely, if ever, get any of the same type of coverage that are given the other types of attacks that that were mentioned.
Thank you very much, Dahir. Our next caller is John from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. John, your question for Dahir, please.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Very briefly, first of all, my admiration for you being, for going there, and also admiration for how well you speak. My question in brief is, it seems to me that a people will not embrace their government, either the current government or a future government, unless their basic needs are met. An adequate supply of drinking water, clean drinking water, a continuous and uninterrupted supply of electricity, a decent sewage system, and food. You mentioned that food is a problem. What about the other three? What's the state of affairs in terms of electricity, clean water, and a sewage system? And what's your prognosis, your projection into the future about when these matters will be fixed? Because if they're not fixed, these people aren't going to accept any government. Please go ahead.
No, that's a very important point, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll be as brief as I can. But the overall infrastructure is on all measurable levels in Iraq now far, far worse than it was before the invasion. And again, this is all according to hard facts. The average house in Iraq now has between 1 and 2 hours of electricity per day. Even in Baghdad, that's the case, according to the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. 70% of Iraqis don't have access to safe drinking water. We could go on down the line, but again, as the caller said accurately, this is one of the primary reasons, this and the security situation, of course, why the so-called Iraqi government does not have any popular support whatsoever. And I certainly can't foresee a legitimate Iraqi government, and then, of course, following that, a legitimate attempt to rebuild and reconstruct Iraq's crumbled and devastated infrastructure until the occupation is over. There basically will not be sovereignty in Iraq, and there will not be a government that truly has popular support until the occupation is over, because the current Iraqi government basically will not survive on its own without U.S. support. And as long as it has itself in that conundrum, it will not have popular support, and therefore there will not be security available so that reconstruction projects necessary can be carried out.
Dahir, we only have a couple of minutes, but I do want to touch quickly on the Iraqi hospitals ailing under occupation. You speak about medicine shortages, equipment shortages, supply shortages, the fact that there's no reconstruction happening in these areas. The major findings was that it appears that the standard operating procedure in the military of a deliberate targeting of hospitals, ambulances, and medical workers. Can you touch briefly on that for us?
Yes, the medical situation is in crisis, and again, if you look at where it came from, which was the period of the 13-year period of the sanctions prior to the U.S.-led invasion, the medical system basically had no time and ability to rehabilitate itself and try to get its legs back under it from the period of the sanctions to right now, because the occupation was so brutal and devastating almost from the very beginning. That coupled with rampant corruption within the Iraqi Ministry of Health, and then as we outlined earlier, corruption with the Western contractors like Bechtel, who was awarded $1 billion in contracts just for the Iraqi Ministry of Health itself. Or I'm sorry, the Iraqi Ministry of Health was supposed to get $1 billion from the Coalition Provisional Authority, and it did not obtain most of that money. But Bechtel was theoretically going to be involved in some of that reconstruction assistance, and of course that in large part did not happen either. So we have a situation today where actually almost half of Iraq's doctors have fled the country because of the violence and because they've been primary targets of kidnappings and then ransom extortions from their families. And then today, going across the board, most hospitals in Iraq do not have adequate supplies, medicines, or medical instruments even to carry out basic care for people. So it is in a state of crisis. And, of course, this is another part of the infrastructure that is sure to get worse over time.
We have to break this off right now, and we've come to the end of the show. But before we go, I'd like to ask you in 20 seconds or less, is Iraq better off today than it was prior to the attack?
All the facts on the ground speak for themselves, and that's, as I just said, on every measurable level, the average person in Iraq finds things much worse today than before the U.S.-led invasion was commenced in March 2003, and that includes oil exports for the country, to safe drinking water, to medical care, to job availability, and, of course, to security.
Thank you very much, Dahan. You've been a wonderful guest. We're hoping to have you back soon so that we can follow up on what's happening in Iraq from real reporting and not sensational reporting. Folks, this is The People Speak with Dahan Jamil this evening. Next week's guest is Ellen Mariani, 911 widow who sued Bush for the death of her husband. She'll be the guest on The People Speak September 11th at 8:30 to 9:30. We're going to be changing our time next week, folks. 8:30 to 9:30 Eastern in The People Speak. Thank you very much. Thank you, Daher.
This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw love made that endless skyway, and I saw below me a golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me.